4 for December 29th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Father Time.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We are here with, okay, 2020 is almost over. We can declare an end to 2020 this week, folks.
Did we beat COVID?
COVID is over. Don't worry about COVID. The election is over. Don't worry about the election. Wonder Woman is a movie, and we don't worry about that. Everything's fine.
And hackers are still among us, so I think we're ready for 2021.
Great! Way to look forward to the new year. You know, Charles Dickens looked forward to the new year too, Pam, and there were no hackers that I'm aware of in 1844. The story that we're discussing today is The Chimes. This was published in 1844. Charles Dickens' story of new year, new ideas, renewal of all of the things that happen in Victorian society. And they kind of apply to 2020, don't they?
They do. They certainly do.
So, in order to celebrate the new year, it is time to go to the theater and to experience The Chimes. But 2020 has kept us from the theater. So, we have with us today Nick Sandys from the Remy Bumpo Theater Company, who has given us the gift of the new year. He has a performance of The Chimes where he performs this as Charles Dickens maybe would have performed it in 1844. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. Merry Christmas, everyone. Or in this case, a Happy New Year as we approach the new year. There is a wonderful thing that, you know, that happens at the end of The Chimes, and there's a blessing from Dickens, which now I use in everyday life. It's like, let's look to the new year quickly.
So we are happy to have you for sure, and we're so happy to see your ability to send us the joy of theatrical entertainment, even in this mysterious land of 2020 and COVID. The Remy Bumpo Theater Company has given us the gift of your performance of The Chimes. You can go to remybumpo.org, and I'll have that in the show notes to make the spelling just right. And first, I just want to thank you for this performance, sir.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's been a show that's been in my life for a while. I performed it live for Remy Bumpo in 2012, and then the repeat in 2013. So this has been readapted, obviously, to this format, since we could only do it. We actually had to record it in my house. I had to record it in my house with my assistant director and my stage manager on Zoom watching me record it. So we were being as safe as we possibly could, but it was a way of us getting some storytelling out there, and a message of hope for the new year. It's about renewal. It's about being aware of other people, even while we can't be in their company. And it's a story that tries to be as engaged with society as it possibly can. And that's why he was writing it. I mean, it was an activist story. It was actually shocking at the time. People, you know, criticized how socially active it was, because it was engaging with its historical moment in a very, very positive way. And he's championing the poor, as he always does. You know, his brother-in-law, was it John Forster, who was his first biographer, you know, said that, you know, the previous year he had reformed Scrooge, and with this story he wanted to reform society. So it's a little bit more engaged, but so yeah, it's a story. If you read it out loud, it's over 3 hours if you do the whole thing. So I've cut it down to about 90 minutes and had to abridge it, because I feel like that's as much as you should be made to watch something on Zoom. But there's a lot of invention going out there. There's a huge amount of theatre happening online. And it's not the same as live in any shape or form, but it is allowing the arts to be out there. And, you know, our patrons are supporting it. And there's been a lot of giving around the year, which has been really important to us. So I'm pleased that we could get this out for the new year and celebrate it. It's streaming through January the 3rd, hoping that people after Christmas will go, what else is going on? I've watched The Christmas Carol 16 million times. What else did he do? You know, and you get that sort of feel.
Let's go back to the theater that's putting this on. Where did the name, and that's the Remy Bumpo Theater Company, right, is in Chicago. So where did this name come from?
It was a temporary name, actually, from the founder, James Bonan, who founded this company in 1996. He wasn't going to have another theater in Chicago. There are just enough theaters in Chicago. And he was looking to do it somewhere else, but he wanted to start producing and directing. He is a director. He actually now runs a lovely bookstore, independent bookstore, up in Spring Green, Wisconsin, where he also directs for American Players Theater. He wanted to start producing and become an not-for-profit theater, which you have to be in business for a few years. And so he named it after two pets, a cat called Remy, and his own dog, which was called Natty Bumpo. And if you want to know, there's your literary thing. There's Nathaniel Bumpo, which is, of course, the actual store name of Hawkeye in the James Fenimore Cooper novels, the Leatherstocking novels. And so that sort of background is who we are. And I say, it's because he also brought his dog into rehearsal, as he always brings his dog into rehearsal because he believes people behave better when there are animals in the room. So there's no sort of tantrum from actors. But and Natty was part of the shows. He would, if there was a rug on, he would walk up on the stage and just sort of lie down and go to sleep, and you get used to walking over the dog while you were blocking a show. It was just part of who we are. So even the show that I directed last fall, we were doing our own world premiere adaptation of Howard's End by E.M. Forster, which we'd commissioned, and I was directing it. And we had several dogs. The stage managers or my dog would be in rehearsal room, and it just helps people be warm and open and feel comforted in the room. So it became part of who we are. But it's a sign of what we do. Remy, Remy Martin, sort of classic European culture to a certain extent. Remy Martin brandy, the champagne brandy from the 18th century, mixed with sort of American frontiersman sort of guts. That's what we hope to bring together.
I love that. And I did want to just say that I really, really appreciated that the show actually opened with an Indigenous people statement. And of course, we do that at UConn, and I mean, most universities do, and lots of other places. But what I really liked about your statement was that it started with that acknowledgement of the stewardship of Native American peoples. And then it moved to the idea of art, mm-hmm. art, environment, social justice, all sort of having this need to look back at legacies and to look back at history. And so I just really wanted to commend you on what I thought was like just a really wonderful opening statement.
Thank you for saying that. Well, we're still working on it, as everybody is, as we all have been called to accountability and recognition and all those things, which we've been working on for a long time, but slowly. And so this yes. summer has accelerated that work and made it, put it really front and center, which is really important for everybody. And in fact, my wife was for many years in a great friendship with an Indigenous medicine woman down there. And so just being attentive to that and knowing that storytelling is part of an oral culture, and to be able to tell stories in that way. And yeah, I think this is a great development for not only us as a company, but the industry as a whole.
Agreed. So why the chimes in particular?
Aside from the fact that, originally I did it because it was like I arrived in America, and America's got this sort of love affair with A Christmas Carol, which when I left England was not the case. I mean, yes, we watched the movie, one of my favorites is The Muppet Christmas Carol, but it's only recently that now we've caught the American disease of everybody doing Christmas Carol as a theatrical piece. It's done everywhere now. The Old Vic's streaming it online, and you cannot escape it. And I'm going, there are these other ones, So it was really that impulse originally. I actually did a stage version of this with about five of my friends from Dallas, where I had been before moving to Chicago, including my wife. We did a five-person version at Christmas when I first got to Chicago, which is just something I was like, no, this is a story that should be told because it's a different story. And everybody loves It's a Wonderful Life. And this is Dickens' version of it's kind of It's a Wonderful Life, mixed with, Dickens-ness. And I feel like that is kind of refreshing. And of course, it was one of his first readings. I mean, he thought this was going to beat The Christmas Carol, as he says, out of the field. And he just sort of, which I put in at the beginning of the performance, because that's from, it's a combination of his apology. When he finally got around to doing this on stage, which was about, 10, 15 years after he had written it, he felt like, well, I wrote this some time ago, and it's sort of, activist, and I apologize for that. Because everybody wanted the sentimental bits. They didn't want the social criticism. when he did the readings, and he just kept cutting out more and more of the social criticism. But this was the first thing he thought would be a great reading, and he started with it as one part of his charity readings in 1853 when he was raising money for a hospital. And so, you know, he thought this would be great to sort of dive in and be theatrical. And so that's why I went to this, and actually it was really sort of fun. Kind of like Patrick Stewart when he did his own cutting of Christmas Carol, when he did the one-man show of Christmas Carol. Then he went back when he found Dickens' own cuttings and found they were pretty similar. And I've done the same thing. You know, you cut it and then you go back to Dickens' original reading text and you go, oh, he cut that too. Oh, that's interesting. But there were certain things I was determined to leave in, I have to say, because I'm interested in that social dimension and that social criticism as well.
You said something to the effect of, with A Christmas Carol, Scrooge is redeemed, but Dickens had a whole different approach to this story.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think the fact that, you know, you've got this wonderful thing that I'm not Scrooge. Oh, I am Scrooge, and if I am like Scrooge, I can be reformed. So there's a sort of way into that story, and everybody else in that story is lovely. You know, there isn't one person who is like hateful. You know, even Marley comes back, and you go, oh, he's okay now because he's seen his wrong ways, but. You know, the scariest thing is, you know, Christmas future, and you're going, nobody wants to be there, but you know it's kind of this it's teaching. But everything's good. And in this story, Trotty and his little put-upon family are at the core of this very disturbingly violent world. You know, and the fact that, you know, there's the vagrancy laws, and Will Fern and Lillian are put down by, you know, anybody who is not actually from that town can be thrown in prison. And this is sort of bringing to a fore that the catch-22 of the poor in that period, in that huge amounts of unemployment and hunger in the hungry for 40s, and everything that's causing the country, which is going to become, you know, the huge emigration of the Scots and the Irish when you add the potato famine from 1845 and starvation, and a million people die, basically, you know, and you've got this huge problem, and it's illegal to move. So you can't go and solve the problem. And that's going to, and he's riding on the cusp of that. So the seeds of that are already happening. And then you've got this amazing political situation at the time, and he picks up this case of this woman who tries to commit suicide, tries to drown herself, Mary Furley, and her baby, because she can't feed the baby. She doesn't know what to do. She's been thrown out of her house. She's lost her housing, so she tries to, and she fails. So she's going to be hung for manslaughter for killing the baby. And it's a huge thing in the press, and this idiot ex Lord Mayor of London, who is now an alderman, Sir Peter Lorry, who he is satirized in the novel as Alderman Cute. I'm going to put it down. I'm going to put suicide down. And all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's insane. But you hear that. I mean, I think it's probably where Pam was going to go earlier. Like, no, we haven't lost idiocy in the people who are in control of this country and this complete privilege of this upper class. Remember, this is before the Chartist movement too, which also happens in the 1840s. So the only people who can vote are privileged land property owning men, you know, I mean, of a certain amount of money. And those are the only people who can vote. Not all men, not anything, you know. So it's just, and that's going to start by with the rebels in the north, you know, trying to bring in the Chartist rebellions and the strikes and everything in the north to try and change the factory situation. So that it's a huge decade, and that's exciting to me that that's in this piece, and that makes it difficult because it's a dark journey. Once Trotty goes on that landslide and believes that the poor are not worthy, and that his lesson is to just dive and keep diving, and then the chimes come in and say, yeah, if you think that's the thing, I'm going to make it even worse and show you that at least you can, your hope brings hope to other people. Your doing good deed spills into other people's world.
And that's one of the questions I had for you, Nick, because as I was reading this, I was thinking about, you know, in literature and obviously in theater too, we always have this sort of difficulty of how to balance didacticism or teaching with entertainment. And as I was reading this, I was thinking, did Dickens succeed or not? And I must admit, this was my first time. I've read so much Dickens in my life. This is my first time reading The Chimes this week. And I couldn't decide, I'll just be honest, that I couldn't decide if he found the right balance between didacticism and entertainment. But you know the text so much better. So give us your read on this. And also having performed it,
I wouldn't say that I know the text any better. I usually say that. But I think he fails. But like any piece, it's like all those wonderful plays that nobody does anymore from, you know, Shakespeare's contemporaries. Because Shakespeare buries his social criticism because he's the king's playwright, and you know, the Lord Chamberlain's playwright to begin with, and the king's playwright. He has to bury his criticism or his questioning of the social order within the story, and he does it actually so well that often you have to really dig, you know. But here's Dickens working as, you know, the new narrative form of the novel, which is new still. I mean, it's 100 years old. That's it. And its whole problem was finding this balance. I mean, you think about the early novels of like Samuel Richardson and Henry Fielding, and Richardson, who's a moralist. And I've got to say, one of the most boring novelists ever. Really important, but all those epistolary novels, they're boring. I mean, Clarissa's a brilliant novel, but it's 8 volumes long. I mean, cut it down. You know, cut it down. You could do it in 2, but it's a fabulous piece of history. And Henry Fielding then responding to it and writing Shamela, because he'd write it, and it's a very short novel, which is the ludicrousness of what he's pointing at. But he writes a, you know, 2-volume novel in Tom Jones, and again, has to put some narrative on the front, and his narrative of the open heart, and, you know, he himself was a justice of the peace, and all that sort of stuff. So it's a fascinating negotiation of politics and their place in the novel, because it's a social form. And the other part of it being, of course, it's the fact that it's a socialist form to a certain extent. It's a reading public that's shifting to the public libraries. You've got a middle class that's becoming literate to a certain extent. You've got, you know, and it's sort of helping to move literacy along. And you've got this amazing point that everybody, when they started, had to worry about truth and falsity. Because, you know, this higher thing of the power of poetry, well, it's poetry, it's drama, it's of a higher level. And the prose was seen as this sort of lower level, and it's all lying. So what is fiction about? And so you've got this negotiation continually with its social justice or social process. And that's fascinating to me, just as the way it moves through, you know, particularly into the, you know, 1820s to 1840s, you move from people like Thackeray into the Brontes and, you know, and George Eliot, and negotiating their position as people, and through their playing with gender and all the different things that are happening. It's so exciting. So to have somebody like Dickens come along from a poor background, you know, his father was in debtor's prison, and, you know, he himself had to go to work at the age of 12, and all those things, that makes him engaged with this, and his energy, you know, that he died at the age of 58, looking like an old man. He wrote this when he was 32, and he looks like a young, as you know, when he came to America, the Louisa May Alcott thought he was just a fop, you know, she was red-nosed fop or whatever she called him, because he just seemed to be this like, hey, I like the attention. There's so much in this that I look at. The Chimes is trying to negotiate that space, and having been given so much attention because of the Christmas Carol, which he just tossed off as a moneymaker, you know, which really what it was a quick novella he could throw in there because his 2 novels were failing. Martin Chuzzlewit was failing and Barnaby Rudge was failing, and, you know, they weren't good sales, and he ended up sort of kind of running away to Italy because it was cheaper, you know, and he could take his family there. And he wrote this in Italy looking for something to get some money. And then it's sort of fascinating that how those things shift and change and negotiate. So I would agree with you. That's a long answer, but I would agree with you that it's a less successful novel. And it helps to actually then be able to cut it down and cut some of that thing out and direct it in many ways. You could not get a more contemporary sounding sentence of not putting jail, jail, jail before us everywhere we turn for the poor being incarcerated in a carceral society. And it sounds like so much of the social justice, calls for social justice this summer. That I feel like another reason that it sounded right to me to bring this back this year.
This is one of the reasons to bring you on, is certainly to help us think a little bit about that. I think one of the black eyes for our generation today is going to be, especially in the United States, the number of people that are incarcerated. It's just so large. Mm-hmm. And it's just, we've got to figure out a better way of dealing with.
Every time you put you could say the same about Dickens. When you read the statistics about the poor or the starving or the death or child death or, you know, the things that were going on that period, you go, how did anybody let any of that happen? Just even if you read a little bit about workhouses, you just go, I want to scream in people's faces. It's so appalling. And then, but we forget. You look at that, exactly, the figures of incarcerated youth, and particularly in communities of color, and you go, what is going on?
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your editing of a live performance. It's very different. You're recording it so that we can watch it through the lens. And in a live performance, you don't have the ability to edit or use different camera angles, but you did.
Yes.
Through this, and I thought that was fascinating. Tell us a little bit about
that. Well, we had to develop a style for it because there were like on these, can I go back and edit that word out or something like that? Trying to take a run at it, but also being the engineer and being able to watch the screen, and you don't really know watch yourself while you're performing, but you're going, I'm out of frame, what am I doing? And so you're constantly having to do it in sort of chunks. And it's in, of course, in the sort of quarters of the quarter hour things. But it was really about the fact that I've done a number of audiobooks in which you're constantly playing your relationship to the microphone. And sort of, if I'm playing multiple characters, and you've done Dracula, and I did an audiobook of Dracula, which was up for awards and things. But you're playing so many characters and so many different dialects. You're going, okay, when I go over here, I'm going to be speaking with, in that one, a Scottish accent. And here, I'm going to be speaking with a Norwegian accent. Over here, I'm going to be, Russian. And so, and you're just doing it with your physicality, and you've got to place the voice in wherever you're putting it. And you're just trying to do it. But you can't play the microphone because that you've got to use for intimacy or if you're suddenly wanting to be, I want to lose my bass notes, I have to lose my chest voice to play the women in the story or whatever it may be. So you're constantly aware of doing that. And it changed completely when you're on video, because then it was like, oh, no, I've got to play forward. I've got to literally play the straight line to the camera. So is this character, you start, for instance, on Will Fern going, he's a stranger and he's distanced, and Trotty's the person who you're intimate with. So Trotty's kind of close, and I also want Trotty to be small, so Trotty's low down, and Will's kind of tall and sort of imposing. So being able to do that with putting that and working out and mapping the physicality of it. So we had about 3 days of rehearsal with me playing with that. And then there'll be like a scene where there's four people, and you're going, well, Trotty's up. No, Trotty's got over here so that I can have Meg and Richard and Lillian, and so I've got to be still in the camera. So it was a game to do that. And fortunately, Ian Frank, the associate artistic director, he edited the show for us and was able to sort of go, to be able to make the cuts that we had to do, we wanted to disguise any cuts we had to do by creating a camera that would move between characters. So he would change the depth of field or change the focus or do something disorientating for one of the sort of villainous characters so that the angle would sort of shift on the lens. So he could do that in editing afterwards that would accentuate the things that I'm doing physically. So we used this, we tried to play with the storytelling. He did a great job of this.
There is no doubt that this performance is captured in this technology, and it's there. But and the whole time I was thinking, I would love to see this on stage, to see you for real with an audience playing to the audience. That's the hardest part for me, is not having the audience to play to talk into this void that is my existence for the last 9 months. And to hope that what I'm saying is reaching my audience. You did a fantastic job with that, sir.
It's one of the things that Ian and I talked about, and he confessed to this. It was his worry when editing it. You can edit it tighter. You can cut out some of the transitions he left in. He didn't cut a second out of the time. So you don't cut any time. If I'm playing a character over here, there's transition time when I came over here. And what he did was cut between characters, so you got a sort of movement and cut the frame. But he didn't cut time out, because occasionally you needed that time to hear the statement of the person. And if I'm playing with time as a performer, sometimes the character comes straight in, sometimes interrupts, but sometimes you're just taking the time to respond to that. And I've since actually, for another theatre company I've done as a Christmas little thing, I've edited a shortened version of The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle for Christmas, which is a light-hearted Holmes.
It's one of our favorites when we went through Holmes, for sure.
And of course, it's mainly just Watson and Holmes. So I'm playing all the characters. And having done Holmes a number of times, that's easy for me to get into. Playing the other ones is difficult. But there's only five characters really in the whole story. But yeah, you miss an audience because audiences get to react. I mean, they did this on stage and I couldn't do, like, we couldn't do reverb on my voice for, as we do for the bells here, which is really the only special effect.
Wrong.
Yes. But I would do that vocally and I would just sort of make it as big as I could. And it was massive. And I'm lucky to have a very loud voice. But it's one of those things that I could play with and echo my voice just sort of vocally and just be sort of, you know, just one of those things where you go, this is, when do you get to do this as an actor? It's just delightful.
And this story is so dialogue driven. This is way more dialogue than we see in any of the other Dickens Christmas stories. We're going through them one at a time here. And this one is so much dialogue, trying to find that right mix of putting the air between the lines so that the audience has time to hear those words. That's something that I try to teach it with my students all the time is you know what he's going to say. You've read the script. You know what she's going to say, but the audience has no idea. You need to give them the time. That's one of the hardest things to do in acting.
It is. But it's also that, you know, you don't want to give them too much time. You've got to work out where you want that time to be. That's when James put us together as a company, that was his biggest thing. It's like, for him, it was always earn the pause. So, you know, it's rhetoric. It's simple rhetoric. Where do you want the sense to get to be the time? That's the complete thought. If you give them a pause after every line, they're ahead of you. And if the audience is ahead of you, they don't need to listen to the rest of the story. So you're always going, I want to be on top of that. I want to be on top of that and top of that. And now I'm going to give you the time to catch up. Now we move on to the next thing. And it's just like structuring. I mean, if you read Cicero or anything like that, it's structuring an argument. It's listening to that sort of theater is bringing an argument to you in a different way. You know, if you're reading on the page, you read at your own pace, whatever it is. But in theater, because it's live, you are bringing a court case. You are staging something, an argument that's asking for you to take on facts as you hear them and judge them. And that means you give them space when you want to say, and there's the complete thought. Think about that. And there's the complete thought. Think about that. And that's always about pacing and trying to judge that.
Obviously, Dickens has a lot of interest in class. Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about how this kind of plays in the story and does Dickens make a really good case?
Well, I think he's loaded the dice a bit, but, you know, I mean, he's also, I thought fascinating, one of the things he makes the enemy here is the newspaper. It's how people read about themselves and how they're depicted. So it's how culture, particularly the cultural order, depicts that land. I mean, I think this one of the most important books that have come out this summer is Isabel Wilkerson's Caste, which is a brilliant, mm-hmm. you know, sort of stripping down of American society and shifting it in a way of thinking about race and class and sure. looking at it as a caste society. And I think that's it's what's great about that is one of the Brecht, for all his horribleness, gives me some of the most important things in theater. And that is the Verfremdungs effect, which everybody says, oh, yeah, estrangement or alienation, blah, blah, blah. What does it actually mean? For me, it means to make strange again, Verfremdung, to make strange again. Our job in telling any of these stories is to make something strange again so that you actually look at it. You know, that's what it's about. It's like, don't take it for granted. Look at it. And so I think that's the greatest advantage in this. Whether it's clumsy, whether it makes all of the poor people, the best people here, which he does. He flips it again. You know, it's the poorer, beautiful people here. There isn't a sort of bad, poor person. Well, there is Tugby. I hasten to add Tugby, the other porter, the porter, who is a villain. So there is one thrown in there and who throws Meg out at the end. But, you know, the middle classes are seen as villains, the pilers and filers of the world, you know, and then the upper classes, definitely. Sir Joseph, who is, you know, go, the dignity of labor. Go out into the fresh morning air and stay there. You know, all that sort of stuff. It's just wonderfully funny, but it's also devastating. So it's like, it's very loaded. It's not an even case. That's what he wants in there. He wants to open your eyes to other people's experience of the world.
usually when I'm reading something, I'm so busy just trying to get through the material. But you just talked about a deeper way of entering this material by just going, oh, where is this person from? Where is their background from? This is how to get, just a deeper meaning from your reading. It's obviously just thinking that way has the potential of making a person a deeper reader.
I think it's really important, even though it sort of fell out of favor with new criticism, all that sort of stuff where you go, you can't use the biography of the person who's writing this. Their words are just their words. And you go, really? Hawthorne? Really? Thoreau? Really? You really want to take that out of the picture? That you've got to know where those people come from. Louisa May Alcott. I mean, the great American writers come from a very specific place and time. And the fact that Thoreau, you go, yes, living Walden Pond, living on his own. Well, not really. The local people brought him food and, all that sort of stuff. So he was really living a quite privileged life while he cut his chunk of ice. You've got to put it into context. But I think it's really important that knowing that my thing, and that's partly because I come from the north of England. I grew up in the north of England, even though I was born in Coventry, but I grew up in the north of England. And what is missing in an understanding of English literature, and which the novel is a huge part of, is the split between North and South. You have it here, gangbusters, okay? It's still going on. It's lived every day. Here am I in my house in Indiana, which is like a different country from Illinois. It's an amazing border. And yet porous, and it's sort of fascinating. But it's, in England, that's the same thing, and the idea that every novelist is negotiating that, everybody went up to London, you go up to the city when in fact it's south, because it's seen as this sort of citadel on a hill. And that's sort of frightening, and Scotland, of course, is in rebellion to that. But the North Country is definitely in rebellion to that. So Lancashire and Yorkshire and, you think about those Shakespearean history plays where those are the two powers, that Lancashire and Yorkshire are fighting it out, and London can go do whatever it wants because it's actually French. Richard II is actually French, the Plantagenets, and all that sort of stuff. So you're going, we forget that when we read those plays. We go, English, oh, English, English. No. Major, major problems. So for me, that's always been part of how I've looked at this work. And because of my study in medieval drama, particularly, and looking at the each culture, each city bringing forward its version of the Bible stories and how they inflected that and marked them and the language they used. And that's fascinating to me because I grew up in York and then studied that and was working on that with my PhD and stuff. And it's inflected the way I look at all drama. So that's a way in for me when I look at the novel. I look at the context of why this person, for me, putting on a play. Why was this play written when it was written? I've got to get back. It's not about me wanting to stage a play because I have these ideas and let me find a play that goes with my ideas. I want to put on a play that talks to this moment because it's talking about the same things. That's why I choose a play to put on. It's not because of me. It's because the play and the time have a conversation to have. I'm just the conduit for that.
I could take this in a lot of directions, but let's move to towards the ending where, you're Charles Dickens and you say, is this a dream? And then basically does it matter? And Dickens asks the observer to soften their heart and recognize how the individual impacts her surroundings. And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, he's trying to get this moral from the story, and you've got the vision in the middle of it. And actually, there's a vision kind of at the beginning of the story. Like the first two or three pages of the story are brilliant. His description of the tower and the bells and everything. And actually, when I did the stage version, had about a page version of that on the front of it. And I just went, nope, I'm going to start straight in with Trotty because that's where the heart of the story. It's kind of a distraction. But I would recommend, because it's just full of wonderful Dickensian language and humor. Like the whole thing of, nobody wants to sleep in a church. I'm not saying, on a Sunday during on a warm Sunday and during a sermon when it has been done once or twice, just that sort of irony and wonderful warm humor of understanding. And unfortunately, I had to lose some of those things, which, there's so many other good ones. And there's so many things like the little guy who comes in with the chimes at the end, who walks in with all the musicians for the band. And he says, and in they came with the chimes, not those chimes. a little set, you know, on a stand, and just sort of little tiny wonderful things, which I had in the stage version because you could sort of pick up a prop and do that sort of visual thing. But yeah, that final ending, that idea of this excusing the writer's writing by making it a dream, pans right back to what I was saying about literary tradition. I mean, you think about all of those, even the medieval tradition, the vision of Pearl, you know, the idea that the dream within the dream, you go to Freudian, is the truth. You know, I mean, everybody's played with that, that inspiration happens when you're asleep. And one of my favorite pictures of Dickens is that wonderful illustration, which is called Dickens' Dream, which was actually done by an illustrator as he was dying. Basically, he failed to complete it because Dickens died. And you can see it, you can just look up Dickens' Dream. And it's an incomplete illustration, and Dickens is in full color. And he started to colorize it. And then it goes into sepia tone sketching. And it's all the characters. And he's just asleep at his desk in Gad's Hill, in his office. And it's a vision of all the characters from all the different books, all these little scenes floating in the air from his head. And it's just a lovely idea that the artist is a dreamer, you know. And for me, that translates as, it's our responsibility to dream what could be, you know. It's our responsibility to depict a better society. It's our responsibility to say, can we be better human beings? What is the purpose of art? It's to show ourselves the sublime, something higher, something, you know. We don't have to just, you know, sometimes, yes, you're going to do a tragedy to say, this is what you should not do. I mean, I work in opera, and it's like, and this, all these tragedies, don't do this, you know. Don't kill people and then commit suicide or die of, you know, consumption. That's a bad idea, even though you might sing beautifully on the way. But the idea that, you know, I mean, one of the greatest plays for me is King Lear, you know, because it takes humanity down to its core. And the greatest Shakespearean line ever, that never, 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 never. That's a whole iambic pentameter line. That's it. That's the ultimate thing. It's like Beckett saw it in that, you know, in that line. And just sort of feeling of that you can show that essence with what you're doing and why we're here. So I think Dickens is trying to get onto that with that dream. Mm-hmm. But it's also an excuse. It's kind of it's a little cheat at the end of the novel going, oh, it was all a dream. Was it a dream? Was I really dreaming? Are you in a dream world now? Was Trotty in a dream? When he's done all this social activism and you just got, oh, you just chickened out at the last moment, didn't you? Because you had to sort of sleep with it. So for me, it's sweet. It's a wishing for the new year to be a gift. It's his sort of little prayer, you know, and that lovely thing, which I now use, which is that may this new year be a happy one to you and to many more whose happiness depends on you, is a wonderful blessing to sort of think about, oh, that's what this story is about. I now sign off with that, you know, because it's a way of thinking about the world, that your happiness generates so much more. You are the center of a web, and what you put out into the world. I mean, like so many spiritual sort of thinking, so much.
Those connections, you know, they reverberate over and over and over.
You do a good deed and those deeds spread, you know, and it's not your job to go, oh, it didn't work this time. It's to keep doing it. It echoes out like the chimes. Those reverberate, you know, and that for me is what the, you know, the title's about, why that, I miss that tradition. I grew up in, you know, as I said a couple of times, I grew up in New York. Where in medieval York, or even Elizabethan York, one of the great, inside the city walls, which is basically 5 square miles, mm-hmm. there were enough churches that you could go to a different church every Sunday of the year. And you could drink at a bar, at a different bar, every other night of the year.
I think you described the southern United States right there.
Right, there you go. But, you know, that's in this tiny medieval city. And I grew up with that because we would still do the ringing in of the new year. That all these little churches would get out there, even if the bells had gone that sort of bad and all that sort of stuff. But I lived, because my father was a chorister at York Minster, so I lived in the house, two and a half medieval cottages, which had been slammed together and then had we had a 17th century sitting room and an 18th century. You know, it wasn't ours, we rented it. The Historical Society owned it. But it was right by the Minster. So I had been up in that bell tower. I've rung the bell when I was allowed to, when I was like 15. And so Great Peter, which is this brother bell to Big Ben at the Houses of Parliament. And so hearing that, when they put the dampers on the bells at 11 o'clock or 11:30 at night on New Year's Eve, and so the bells sort of ring out in this muffled oh, slightly saddened, slightly flat sort of tone all across. Anybody that has bells still does that. And then they pull the dampers off at midnight and everything rings out and swings as loud as they can go. It's just a joyous sound. It's always that tradition that you hear the bells ring at the new year. And that's such a transformational sort of blessing as we move into 2021.
And Nick, I really want to thank you for bringing up Dickens's really utopian impulse in this work. I mean, all social critique has that utopian impulse, but I think I really love that you drew our attention to how this ending, maybe even more than the endings of the other Christmas stories we've looked at, really has both that critique, but also that hope for the future, which we need so much at this
moment. Yes, exactly. Thank you. Yeah, there's so much in this. I mean, there are other things on our website. You know, we do a lecture series called Between the Lines. And I talked with Sarah Moulton, who is the current secretary of the Dickens Society. And she's a professor of Victorian literature up at St. Mary's in Nova Scotia. And so we just chatted. She gave a 25 minute lecture. And then we just chatted. And that's available on our website for free if you go to the show page. And it's just sort of fun to be able to talk with people who pull out these different things, and I go, yeah, it makes me go, I should be more clear about that idea, you know, and it wants me, I want to go back in and perform it again and look at these different things. You know, see, she brought up a couple of images. I went, of course that's what that is. I never even thought about it that way. And, you know, just sort of, and from the literary side of it. So it's just great to be able to just talk about this stuff and pull it apart and then go back and do more. You always, my philosophy is always, the next time I do this, it's going to be better. So, you know, we'll do it. We'll do it again.
And that's been the fun of this book club, is looking at this, all of this literature from so many different perspectives, to get the idea of the historical reasoning behind it sometimes, and to get the current viewpoint of it sometimes, and to have our three different perspectives, from Chip's upbringing in North Carolina and my Chicago viewpoint and Pam's Canadian / South
Canada.
It
represents the whole country right there. It's just one thing.
Right.
What a special treat it is to have you here today, talking a little bit about Charles Dickens, The Chimes, and obviously the wonderful work you're doing at the Remy Bumpo Theater Company. How can our listeners find out more about your current projects and also about the projects of the theater?
Right now we have, you can go to our website, Remy Bumpo, remybumpo.org, and go to shows up there, and that'll have all the information about The Chimes, which is what's streaming right now through tickets available through the website. It's streaming anytime on demand till January the 3rd through the new year. And we're going to be putting out a new slate of classes. We've been teaching classes online. Everything is on our website. They're sort of, basically, we do sort of book clubs and appreciation of theatre and all different things, theatre history, all that sort of stuff, but just with a group of patrons who are like talking about it and doing those things. And I run a summer book club through that goes every month all the way through the summer. We're talking about plays. And then we will be announcing shortly what we're doing, because everybody's on hiatus at the moment. We've had to put all our plans, you know, sort of like, because nobody can put dates on anything. We're all waiting at the starting gate for when we go, yes, we can go. So we should be announcing our next season, which should start, I would say, we're looking at trying to do something outside in the late spring, early summer, because at least people might be able to come out to that. So there'll be more news on our website about that. And then in the fall, aiming to start again in the fall with a full season and do three more shows down there. So looking to bring back some of the ideas we were looking at last spring and sort of move them forward. And there's always, you know, we're always looking for ways to move forward, ways to challenge ourselves. So we're also looking, like everybody else, at doing a couple of Zoom readings of plays, possibly radio format, because it feels like that's actually more successful when people can just not worry about what's on the screen and let their minds go with the literary aspect of it. So experimenting with that, always experimenting. We're very lucky that our patrons have been wonderful and have kept us afloat through some great generosity. So we're not struggling for that. But we're really looking forward to the new year, as is, I think, everybody.
Wonderful. So thank you so much, Nick Sandys from the Remy Bumpo Theater Company. Thank you so much for this performance. Thank you so much for keeping the arts on the forefront of our minds in these troubled times. And thank you so much for this idea of renewal for 2021. I want you to, what was your favorite line from this show again, Nick?
It comes from right at the end. It is, "May this new year be a happy one to you and to many more whose happiness depends on you."
Thanks again to Nick Sands from the Remy Bumpo Theater Company for joining us to explain in depth, wow, such depth that he goes to in preparing his performance of The Chimes by Charles Dickens. Once again, you can get that. You can download it. It's on-demand streaming from now through the new year, January 3rd, 2021. Go to remybumpo.org to find that.
Yeah, that was a wonderful, wonderful conversation. Thank you, Nick.
This is the last show of 2020. We've gotten through 2020, and the new year brings us a new title for our book club. And Pam, it's your turn once again. So what is our next book?
Guys, I'm going hardcore Canadian, and I'm also going to the turn of the century. So Robert J. Sawyer is, I think I can safely say, Canada's premier living science fiction writer. He's amazing, 24 novels. I'm reading his new one, The Oppenheimer Experiment, right now. It's fantastic. I want to go back in time a little bit. Steve and I share a love of time travel. And I want to do flash forward from 1999.
Ah, the late 1900s, the turn of the century, as you put it.
So what chapters are we going to read to prepare for next week?
So we'll read this book in three parts, and it breaks really easily. So part one is about the first third of the book, and that's what we'll read for next week. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this novel.
So chapters 1 through 11.
Perfect.
Wonderful. I look forward to it. I look forward to a turn of the century novel that is not in the Victorian era, which is, thank you, Pam, for finally bringing us a book that's not Victorian. It's fine. The Victorian era is great. I'm glad to have you here to tell us all about it. But boy, we're going to party like it's 1999 with this one.
Oh, yeah.
I hope everybody out there is having a wonderful celebration of 2020, maybe burning some things to try to get the stink of 2020 out of the house, and looking forward to 2021, which is going to be fantastic. It's going to be great. It's going to be fine. Everything's fine. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive into the new year. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
Yeah, next week is 2021. Pam, are you ready for 2021?
Am I ever.
We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. And thank you all for joining us. Thank you so much for 2020. It was this whole new adventure. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Baby New Year.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you in the future. Here we are, and here we go.